We're very pleased to continue this study of the book of Proverbs. We're still in the 16th chapter of Proverbs. And in our last lesson, we'd gotten into the 25th verse. But we still have a few things we'd like to say about that 25th verse. It reads like this: "There is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." NIV says there is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death. We had this proverb in chapter 14, verse 12. So the very fact that it's given again here is strong emphasis to us as to how important this subject is. It is most important that we not allow ourselves to believe that something is right when really it is not right. Just because it seems to be right to us doesn't make it right. It must be something that is according to God's will. And we read from Isaiah 55, and I'd like to read that again, how that our ways and our thoughts are not the same as God's ways and God's thoughts. So if we just go by what we think about something, we're going to be different from what God thinks. Isaiah 55, 7 and 8, "Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return unto the Lord, and have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So we must have the Word of God to guide us in all our thoughts and beliefs. Otherwise, we can be easily deceived into believing that something is right when it is actually wrong. The Bible must be our guide. And unfortunately, the vast majority of people will make the mistake of following a way that seems to be right, but it leads to death. So do not be misled by the many. Do not allow your human reasoning to deceive you into something that will lead you to destruction. Instead, choose the way of life. We must develop a love for the truth. We must have no belief or action which will be contrary to the truth. In 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 10 through 12, "Because they received not the love of the truth that they might be saved, and for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." This passage teaches us that if we don't have a love for the truth, that we're going to be given a strong delusion that we should believe a lie. Now, a strong delusion is a strong false belief. God will actually give a strong false belief to those who do not love the truth. Now, to love the truth means you don't want to do any damage or harm to the truth. You want to preserve the truth intact and preserve it as truth, because any change in the truth makes it no longer the truth. So we must have a love for the truth, and when we do that, then we're on the road to not being deceived into thinking that we're doing something that's right when actually it's not right. When we demonstrate to God that we do not have a love for the truth, we're simply not wanting the truth. To do damage to the truth in any way is proof you do not want the truth. Then God has promised to send the strong delusion, a strong false belief, that those who love not the truth might be damned. These people with a strong delusion, sent to them by God, will have a way that seems to be right to them, but it leads to death. Just because you have a strong belief does not make it right. Just because many others believe this same belief you have does not make it right. It can simply be a strong delusion that will take you to hell. So let us develop a love for the truth, so that we want what is right, so that the things that we believe, the ways that seem right to us, are consistent with the ways that God teaches. We're according to God's Word. And then we can be assured that what we're doing is pleasing to God. So let's read again verse 25. "There is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." NIV, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but in the end it leads to death." The next proverb is in verse 26. "He that laboreth for himself, for his mouth craveth it of him." This proverb is designed to encourage us to be occupied at something which is worthy of our time and effort. What our hands find to do, we should do with all of our might. This is true in our worldly business as well as in our work for God. The word here used for "he" can refer to the soul as well as to the body. The work here referred to is work we do from the heart, work we have an interest in, work at which we strive to do a good job. This includes the physical work that is absolutely needful, for he says the mouth craveth it. The necessities of both soul and body are pressing. They require constant relief, so that we must either work or starve. Soul and body both call for daily bread. Therefore we must labor daily for our bread, for in the sweat of our face must we eat it, according to Genesis 3:19. 2 Thessalonians 3:10 says, "For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat." But our spiritual needs also must be met. We have to meet both the physical needs of the body and the needs of the spirit. 1 Peter 2:2-3 says, "As newborn babes, desire the sincere milk of the word, that ye may grow thereby. If so be ye have tasted that the Lord is precious." Both of these needs for nourishment are to be taken on a daily basis, spiritual and physical. Yet the most important part of our labor is that reward we cannot fully get at this time. We can't see it at this time. He that labors shall reap the fruit of his labor, both now and in eternity. This reward shall be for himself, the proverb says. He shall rejoice in his own work, eat the labor of his own hands. If we make God's work our business, he will make it our blessedness. So we read again, verse 26, "He that laboreth for himself, for his mouth craveth it of him." NIV says, "The laborer's appetite works for him, his hunger drives him on." Our next proverb is found in verses 27 and 28. "An ungodly man diggeth up evil, and in his lips there is a burning fire. A froward man soweth strife, and a whisperer separateth chief friends." There are some people who are always looking for ways to make life miserable for others. These persons are referred to in this proverb as being ungodly and froward. Froward includes the idea of a person continuing in an evil action, although he knows it's wrong. Verse 27 speaks of an ungodly man who diggeth up evil. It seems that this person does all he can to destroy some other person's character. They use such means as malicious false statements and misrepresentations designed to ruin others' reputation. They dig up evil. They work at this ungodly activity. They take great pains to find out something on which to base a slander or which to suggest it. If none appear above ground, rather than let the matter go, they'll go dig for it. They may intrude upon some private and secret event or circumstance. They may look into the distant past, or they may plant suspicions, evil surmisings, and evil insinuations. A proverb says, "In his lips there is a burning fire." This fire will not only mar his neighbor's good name by tarnishing it with this fiery smoke from his lips, but as a burning fire he will destroy his neighbor's good reputation. And just how great a matter does a little fire like this kindle, and how hard is it extinguished? James 3:5-6 says, "Even so the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. As the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity, so is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell." This person in verse 28 is called a froward man. This is the one who continues doing evil even when he knows it's wrong. This froward man soweth strife. He works hard at destroying friendships by sowing strife. They do this by suggesting things on both sides, things which will set their friends at variance. Or at least it'll cool their friendship and alienate their affection for each other. This froward man usually cannot love anyone but himself. It bothers him to see others have a friendly relationship, so he makes it his business to sow strife. He makes friends look bad to one another by telling lies and carrying degrading stories from one friend to the other. This is designed to separate them from one another and to make them angry or at least suspicious of one another. They do their dirty work as they whisper. A proverb says, "A froward man soweth strife, and a whisperer separateth good friends." These are bad men and women that do such low-down work. They are doing the devil's work. They truly are his servants. This activity is absolutely condemned by the Bible. The Bible does not allow us to sow strife or to separate good friends. We should promote good relations between all persons rather than sow strife. Let us be on guard that we do not do evil or sow strife. Let us not have a burning fire in our lips or be a whisper that separates friends. So verses 27 and 8 again say, an ungodly man diggeth up evil. In his lips there is a burning fire. A froward man soweth strife, and a whisper separateth chief friends. The next two verses, verses 29 and 30, contain our next proverb. A violent man enticeth his neighbor, and leadeth him into the way that is not good. He shutteth his eyes to devise froward things. Moving his lips, he bringeth evil to pass. In these two verses, we have another type of evil person described to us. We should not copy their actions nor allow them to use their evil methods on us. The word used here for violence includes wickedness, violence, wrong, and oppression. These persons do all the ungodly things they can. They may use force and violence as roaring lions, or fraud and deception as subtle serpents. They are violent persons who have no respect for the rights of others. They give deep meditation as they plan their malicious deeds. They squint their eyes and purse their lips together, showing that they're in deep thought as they invent another evil escapade. They're devising froward things. Their minds may be brilliant, but all their talents are used for the devil. They contrive how to do the greatest mischief to their neighbor without harming themselves. Also, these persons do all they can to entice others to join in with them in doing this mischief. A proverb said he leads him in a way that is not good. That is, he leads in a way that is not honest, nor honorable, nor safe, but it's offensive to God. This is the way which will eventually destroy the one who walks in it. The purpose of this violent man is to ruin others in this world by bringing them into trouble. And he will ruin others in this world by bringing them into sin. So verses 29 and 30 say again, a violent man enticeth his neighbor and leadeth him into the way that is not good. He shutteth his eyes to devise froward things. Moving his lips, he bringeth evil to pass. In verse 31, we have our next proverb. The hoary head is a crown of glory, if it be found in the way of righteousness. NIV says, gray hair is a crown of splendor. It is attained by a righteous life. In general, the older a person is, the more respect others should give to him or her. The older person is expected to have more experience in the things of life and thus should have more wisdom. A major sign of this elderly state is usually the gray hair. A proverb says the hoary head is a crown of glory. Of course, this is speaking in generalities and even has some figurative meaning. Young people fail to realize that many problems they face and shall face have already been experienced by these older persons. Each experience should give more wisdom and understanding to the person living through it. But there is one great qualifying factor that must be taken into consideration when attributing wisdom to the elderly. The hoary head is a crown of glory if it be found in the way of righteousness, according to the King James Version. NIV states it like this, gray hair is a crown of splendor, it is attained by a righteous life. The qualifying factor here is, if it be found in the way of righteousness, then their age truly will be their honor. Old age as such is honorable and commands respect. Leviticus 19:32 says, thou shalt rise up before the hoary head and honor the face of the old man and fear thy God, I am the Lord. But if it be found in the way of wickedness, its honor is forfeited. Its crown is profane. It is laid in the dust. Isaiah 65:20 says, there shall no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. So it's not just age that counts, it's whether or not they live a godly life that counts. If those that are old are to have their due respect, they must be righteous in their old age. Then we have a reason to believe that the multitude of their years have taught them the best wisdom. Older people are closer to the judgment day than younger people. They should of all people be aware of the importance of being found in the way of righteousness. 2 Peter 3:13 and 14, nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that you look for such things, be diligent that you may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. So we know that we're to be on guard and looking for the coming of the Lord. Matthew 24:42-51, watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the goodman of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour that ye think not the Son of Man cometh. Who then is faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household, to give him meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But, and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, My Lord delayeth his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looketh not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. If older people are going to preserve their honor and respect, called for by those gray hairs, they must be found in the way of righteousness. Otherwise, the hoary head becomes a fake crown of glory. If the older person is found in the way of righteousness, then their gray hairs are indeed a crown of glory to them. They are worthy of double honor. How wonderful to combine all the experiences of a long life with godliness. That is true wisdom. So verse 31 says again, the hoary head is a crown of glory if it be found in the way of righteousness. Verse 32, he that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. This proverb is teaching us the importance of self-control. This includes the characteristics of meekness and temperance. We are shown how the benefits of self-control will affect us. It is to be slow to anger. We must not easily be put into a state of wrath. We will take time to consider before responding to provocation. We have time to select the proper response instead of rashly taking actions we later regret. During anger, we are most apt to sin. James 1:20 says, For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. Ephesians 4:26 and 27, Be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil. When we do have anger, we're to rid ourselves of it as soon as possible, before sundown. That's a figurative term, but it really lets us know anger is to be held a very short time. To have self-control is to rule or to be in control of our own spirits, our minds. We control our actions. This means we control our appetites and affections and all our inclinations, but especially our feelings and our anger. We keep our emotions under control. This means that all our actions are in accordance with the laws of God and Christian behavior. This proverb also tells us how honorable it is to have self-control. The one who is able to control his passions and his actions is better than the mighty, according to this proverb. Better than he that by a long siege takes a city, or better than he that after a long hard battle takes a country. Here is one that is better than Alexander the Great, or Caesar. To be able to conquer ourselves, our own unruly passions, requires more true wisdom, a more steady, constant, regular management than obtaining a victory over the forces of an enemy country. A rational victory over a rational creature is more honorable than a brutal one. This is reasoning over force. It is a victory that does nobody any harm. No lives or treasures are lost by the conquest, but only some base lusts. It is harder, and therefore more glorious, to quash an insurrection at home than to resist an invasion from abroad. Meekness and self-control has such great gains that by them we are more than conquerors. So verse 32 says again, He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city. Verse 33, our next proverb, The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. The word for lot actually means a small pebble. The dictionary meaning of the English word lots is objects of various sizes or having different marks used in making a decision. In the Old Testament, when matters could not be decided otherwise, solemn appeals were made to God by prayer, and lots were cast to give the right answer. In Joshua 14:2, the decision as to which territory in Canaan was given to a tribe was determined by casting lots. In Acts 1:24-26, when the apostles were determining who should replace Judas, lots were cast between Barsabas and Matthias, and the lot fell to Matthias to be an apostle. This was done after praying to God to show who he had chosen. So the casting of lots to decide a matter after prayer to God was a practice carried out by God's people in the Old Testament. We do not read of this being done in the New Testament church, which was established on the day of Pentecost, as we read of in Acts chapter 2. So we want to interpret this proverb in this context. Our proverb begins by saying, "The lot is cast into the lap." Many things which seem to simply be done by chance and random events are actually things which the Lord orders and directs. Although the event seems to have just happened by chance, nothing comes to pass by chance. Even when humans make decisions, God is allowing them to act as free moral agents to make these choices. Even though Cain slew his brother Abel, God allowed him to make his choices. So our proverb is saying that nothing is determined by blind fortune, but everything is by the knowledge and permission of God. Our proverb words it like this, "But the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." Now, the examples of the lots being cast were preceded by prayer to God so that he makes the decision. His decision was accepted. So all the events which occur having to do with our affairs must be looked upon as the directing of our lot by God if we have properly prayed to God. When we refer something to God by prayer, then the determining of that matter must be considered to come from God. Then we must be reconciled to the final outcome accordingly. This is another way of describing the true character and nature of a Christian's faith in God. It is much more powerful and deeply rooted than the world can understand. So the verse says again, verse 33, "The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord." That is our lesson. And with this, we conclude the 16th chapter of Proverbs. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.